All right, it's time for a nice discussion with Greg Papa, play-by-play announcer of the San Francisco 49ers. But he's done a lot here in the Bay Area over the past few decades, so I think that we'll have a lot to talk about. I mean, we were just so busy, Greg, over the course of the past few months. We'd check in before all these 49ers games on the field for the little pregame show that I was doing. I just wanted to sit down and just talk now that the season's over. Now we're about to both go to the combine.
Right.
And there's a lot to go through. There really is.
There is. I'm honored you invited me today. I've been a fan of yours since you arrived in the Bay Area and follow your work diligently. And Margo, we have spent time with your lovely bride. And I think you're the one who covers football the best in the Bay Area. We got a lot of people to cover well. I've been in this market for a long time, decades, four. I moved here August of 86 to do the Warriors games and then added the Oakland A's games. But my passion really was professional football growing up in Buffalo and watching the Bills. And so working with the Raiders for so long, 21 years with them, getting so close with Al Davis, learning the game very closely with him and just the access I had there. And then when that fell apart for a lot of reasons, and there were in Vegas, so it wasn't going to work out to go there, falling into the lap of the premier team in the Bay Area history. I mean, they're the only team that was born here, never moved away. They were born in the All-American Conference in 46, and I mean, the A's came from Philly, and the Giants from New York, and the Morabitos. Got to be an Italian to own the team, and it's helpful to be an Italian to broadcast them. So, and my first year, you know, they wind up with Nick Bosa, you know, trade for D-Ford, get Debo, and boom, go to the Super Bowl. And we're 7 minutes, 13 seconds away from winning. And so the first 5 years were Shangri-La outside of the pandemic year of 20, which I don't even know if we had a football season that year. It was so weird. So to go to the championship game four times in 5 years, Super Bowl twice, maybe we were ready for a little market correction for some degree this past year. And now we're looking for a bounce back. So thrilled to talk football with you. I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Well, I still remember sitting down at Raiders training camp a couple years ago when the Niners had the joint practices with the Raiders in Vegas. That was some of the most fun I had. Remember, we were sitting there.
Yeah.
We were two fields away. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you had the binoculars.
I had the Hubble telescope.
telescope.
I was the only game broadcaster that was not permitted to actually walk the field. So John Lynch got a phone call from the then general manager of the Raiders, Dave Ziegler, the night before those joint practices. And it was a message from Mark Davis, the owner of the Raiders, that Pop is not allowed on the field. Anywhere near, you know, at 49ers practices, I roam wherever I respect the players, but I have access to John Lynch complains that I get in the huddle too much. And with the Raiders, I would watch practice with Al Davis and Bruce Allen and Mike Lombardi and whoever was there. So it's complicated why the Raider thing fell apart, but that was tough. Yeah, that was tough because the Raiders have a motto, once a Raider, always a Raider. Except when it applies to me. And then once a traitor, always a traitor would be the line. So that was difficult considering how close I was. That was like a family member, a wife, you know, that may end it badly, but you had a lot of good times for 21 years. So it made just doing my job difficult, but it's fine. We've been in that stadium more times than I choose to remember. The joint practices, playing the preseason games, that epic January 1st game. What was that, 21, 22, whatever year that was? Brock was playing, so.
At Allegiant, overtime game,
34-31. Yeah. And then, obviously, a Super Bowl in that stadium that was also very weird. But it was fitting that it was the Niners and the Chiefs playing at the Raiders' home. And then, you know, a lot of tough losses this franchise endured for those 5 years. But, you know, going to overtime of that game and scoring first in the overtime. Only one other team has lost in overtime in a Super Bowl, and it was Kyle's team in 2016 at Atlanta. No one's lost the Super Bowl when they scored first. So it was hard, but it would have been so nice to win the Super Bowl. You know, I've been with a lot of teams that have been close. The Spurs, I did my second year, we won the championship, but I've had a lot of losses in World Series and Super Bowls, and to get a Super Bowl victory for the team that I broadcast and to do it against the Chiefs in the home of the Raiders would have been fitting.
Yeah. And speaking of your career, there's been so much. And I think that You just brought it up. There have been so many close calls. You mentioned Margo here. She was shocked about 4 months ago. I put on Moneyball for her. And then she saw you in the movie. I know you laugh about that in the production.
I love it. I get $40 every quarter.
The paychecks are still coming,
right? I will buy Margo lunch once every 3 weeks. If you allow, you can come with us. Keep watching, Margo. I actually had scenes
where
I was...
Does that increase the check if there's more?
No. It's pretty much standard. A SAG-AFTRA. I had a scene where I was supposed to be on the field talking to Brad Pitt around the batting cage that got cut. But that was an experience. I mean, I remember going there one day, was in makeup with Philip Seymour Hoffman. He had just done Capote and won the Oscar. And I was like, you know, fanboy, like, Mr. Capote, you were so good. He just walked right by me like I didn't exist. I was like, oh, boy.
Even though you were a co-star.
I put the hand out. I'm like, Art Hobb blew me off the same way. You're getting a character. And then just going, I remember being there one day for hours. We got there like 8 in the morning in a trailer and had makeup. And they didn't call me until 7:30 at night. Bennett Miller, the director, walks in. It's like right out of a Hollywood scene, you know, as we're tape filming the movie. He just puts his hand out, walks in the booth. Somebody puts a cup of coffee in his hand. Like, he doesn't even ask for it. He just puts his hand out, cup of coffee. Do what you do, Greg. I'm like, what do I do? So I just talk him to the open up and I kind of say him, the open A's and the whatever. So it was fascinating. I actually got called back in. So that day I did a scene with Glenn Kuiper. Ray Fossey didn't want to do it. Glenn and I never worked together on Ace TV. He replaced me actually on Ace TV, you know, Dwayne and Jeff's brother. And anyway, like a month later, they called me and we're looking for the 20th game, the Scott Hatterberg home run game. Where's your call that guy? I never broadcasted that because it was on ESPN also. It was a Wednesday night and the Giants were playing the Dodgers. And even though the A's are going for a record that has never been, when they ever won 20, no one has ever won 20. And do you understand what they're trying to do here? It's like Clay Thompson's 37-point quarter. When has anybody ever done? No, it's never happened. So anyway, that's the one time, you know, I've had some great bosses in my life. Tony Salvador, KNBR, Al Davis with the Raiders, and Ted Griggs. I just love Ted and all the different sports channel, whatever we were called, but mainly Comcast, you know, NBC Sports Bay Area now. That's the one time I got into an argument with him because we didn't broadcast that game. We didn't do the Hatterberg when they were up 11-0, lost the lead. Hatterberg gets the walk-off. I watched it on my couch. Dan Shulman called the game on ESPN. Wow. So I was like, why are we not doing this game? He goes, if we're going to take the Giants and Dodgers off the air, and this is Barry Bonds' Giants, I'm like, the rating will be a 10 if it's Giants-Dodgers. Even with the A's going for 20 in a row, it'd be a 5. So then after that, shortly, they started with, you know, Sports Channel, Bay Area, the overlap or overflow channel, plus channels, they call it. So, and then they did California and all that. So anyway, we did not do that game. So they said, can you come in and recreate it? And I said, sure, but just take Bill King's radio calls. Like, his call was amazing of that home run. And then I did go back in and recreate hours of different games and calls. And
so they didn't use your call?
No, they did. They lifted. Like Tejada's the most memorable game I remember that. I remember my family, my kids were young, coming to the booth. It was Labor Day Monday. So Tejada had a game-winning hit off of Minnesota, Eddie Guardado. Every day, Eddie Guardado, base hit to win the game. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a 3-run homer hit to win the game. Then the next day, on Labor Day Monday, it was 19 in a row. He had a game-winning hit against Grimsley of the Royals. They were off on the Tuesday, then set the record on Wednesday, the 20th. But no, they took a number of my calls.
But the Hatterberg one specifically.
No, I never broadcasted the game.
So they told them to make Bill King's.
I think I tried to recreate it for like five minutes and I went, why are we doing this? Just take Bill King's radio call. They took a lot of my calls. They took a lot of Bill King's calls. They took a lot of Ken Korak's calls. They took Bob Costas, you know, when they got to the playoffs against Minnesota, I believe that year. I mean, they did it right. When I first watched the film, I remember being at the Fox Theater in Oakland, and Brad Pitt was there, and Angelina was there. She lived out in Black Hawk where I lived, where real close to me. They actually rented the house in Black Hawk. I remember the scene. I was there. That one day we got some, we could hear a radio call, and she had some code name that meant Angelina's coming. So like the whole facility was on lockdown, like it all this black, you know, Uber, like
motorcade comes in.
Yeah, I was like, here she comes. I saw her for like 5 anyway. She didn't come to the premiere. Brad Pitt was there. And I remember sitting there initially thinking, this is not very good. I didn't like it. Like the whole scene with David Justice with the Coke machine, like they make us pay for
the dollar for the soda.
And I actually did games with David on ESPN. I remember when Halle Berry won the Oscar, first black woman to win an Oscar, I was with him the very next day and their relationship ended not well. Anyway, some of those scenes were like, this never happened. And then, but then as I watched it, I remember being in Europe and watching the subtitles over the summer.
It was like, what language?
I think we were in Greece, so I don't know.
Italy
or Greece, I don't know. It was like, if I finally got hooked on it, I was much better as an Italian man, because I am Italian. Anyway, as I've watched it, I stumble onto it. I watched it from start to finish just the one time at the premiere, and then I don't think I did ever again. And then I stumble into it here and there, and it's better. Every time I see it, it's better. So keep watching, Margo.
Well,
$35 every 3 months. I'll never starve.
I have a story for you on that one. I'm from Visalia, and the A's
single
A affiliate, yeah. The Visalia Oaks, that was the A's single A affiliate. I wasn't in Visalia at the time. My parents went and saw it there, and Brad Pitt mentions Visalia at least twice, maybe 3 times in the movie.
Right.
And I guess the whole theater in Visalia got up and clapped. First time Visalia has ever been mentioned.
Visalia Oaks or the Visalia A's?
It was the Visalia Oaks. And now they're the Visalia Rawhide. Because
of course,
they're Arizona's
makes
team.
Perfect sense.
So, but yeah, back in the day, I mean, they were the Twins team before that. Kirby Puckett came up through Visalia.
Yeah.
I got to see some of the San Jose Giants growing up come through, play against the Oaks. So still remember one of my childhood memories was Jason Schmidt coming in for a rehab assignment, and I got to see him pitch.
When he was a Giant?
Yeah, when he was a Giant. I might have been 12.
People forget how good he was. Man, was he. My first year doing the Giants in 2004, he was as dominant as any pitcher I've ever. I remember him against the Boston Red Sox at whatever the stadium was called then, at China Basin, Third and King.
What year?
2004.
So that was SBC.
Yeah.
Pac-Bell, SBC.
Good.
AT&T, Oracle. Let's go.
What's it now? I get confused.
Oracle.
It's not where the Warriors play? I get very confused.
That's the problem.
Anyway, and I think either Manny, I think Manny was out of the lineup, but they were still, they just won the World Series, and he threw a shutout, like a two-hitter. I remember him going to Chicago to Wrigley that year in 04, throwing a one-hitter and threw like 144 pitches. I mean, he only had 2 pitches, fastball, change. I remember doing a game with Mike Kruko, and I'm like, what's this pitch he throws that's 91? Because he throws a 97-mile-an-hour fastball. I was like, that's his changeup. I'm like, what? That's his changeup. Who throws it? Now they all, a lot of them do. But anyway, Jason Schmidt was, until he got hurt, and then he went to the Dodgers.
He was
as dominant as any Giant pitcher I've seen.
Well, speaking of your time calling the Giants, one thing that I've never gotten to ask you about, but remains fascinating
that home run
to me.
715.
Oh, wow. With Dave Fleming on the call. Yeah. This was at the Coliseum, right?
No, it was at ballpark was called.
Okay, so this was in San Francisco.
Lazy Sunday afternoon. BK Kim is on the mound for Arizona.
And Dave's
got the call.
Has the call, and his mic cuts out. At what point does it cut out of Barry Bonds?
Right when the ball, right when the bat hits the ball. So it was a lazy Sunday afternoon.
Okay.
Very quiet. Whenever Bonds gets, when I first started with the Giants at 04, whenever Bonds got up, the broadcast went, you don't tell stories. I had the same rule with the Bash Brothers, Canseco and Maguire, when I did the A's. It's just, now it's time. The next pitch could go 700 feet. So be ready to adjust. So, but I wasn't doing the game. Dave was. It was a quiet lull. And the moment Bonds hit the ball, it was obviously gone. And this was going to be a home run to pass. When I was a kid, I'm old enough to remember before Henry Aaron got to 755. And I watched Hank Aaron at 714 and 715. And so George Herman Ruth, Babe Ruth, invented the home run.
Yes.
So that was the number, 714. And so for Bonds to hit number 715 and break the record. So the moment the bat hit the ball, it was clearly gone. And it went from a VU meter, you know, when you see a VU meter on the audio, it's down here like 20 to, it's just the whole stadium. It just all, I think what happened was there was just a surge of audio where it went from very low to off the charts high immediately. I lost Dave, but I'm hard of hearing. I mean, legitimately deaf in one ear and hard of hearing in the other. Well, I've done so many games.
Yeah, and the headsets are loud.
Yeah, I remember Grady Lever, our stage manager, when I was doing the A's, he would say to me, he would yell at me. He was like an older man who kind of mentored me and say, you're going to be deaf by the time you're 40. And I go, it's hard for me. I remember, you know, being at Yankee Stadium or Madison Square Garden doing a basketball game. And in order for me to broadcast a game, I have to be able to hear my voice. And I have to round out. You have a beautiful, you round off consonants and you finish sentences. A lot of people swallow words. That's my radio background, even when I do TV, so it bothers me. So I have to be able to hear my own voice. It's difficult to hear it over 50,000 people. So there were nights when I went back after doing the A's game to the hotel, hitting the pillow, and my ears are just...
Because you've cranked up your headset.
I had to hear it over it. So anyway, I'm legitimately hard. It's a problem now. I remember sitting on the dugout bench, and I'm off top with Dwayne Kuiper and Huey Lewis. And we were like three old guys, although I was the youngest one. And we were all telling stories how we're deaf. And, you know, we can't hear anymore. Huey stopped performing because he cannot hear his own voice when he sings. Huey doesn't sing anymore. So anyway, the moment the bat hit the ball and it was gone, it was such a surge. And I lost Dave. So I was like, let's go. I thought maybe the crowd's just over him. That particular day, Lee Hammer, the infamous, famous Lee Hammer, the program director at KNBR, was filling in. It was a Sunday afternoon. And Lee Jones was an engineer, one of my favorite people in broadcasting. I worked Warriors games with him when I first got here. He did Giants, just a kind man and so good at what he does. He took that one day off as the engineer.
Wow.
So Lee Hammer, who's the boss of the station, is filling in, and Lee's roots were doing. Anyway, he hits the ball, you know, I'm just kind of watching. Barrett Bonds goes around first, and Hammer comes running down the steps in the booth. Dave's calling it, and he's grabbing me. He goes, Dave's mic went out. You gotta pick up the call. I'm like, can I use a profanity on this or no? Is that not? Are you effing sure? I'm like the only thing worse is if his mic going out would be me stepping all over his call when Bonds hit second. So he's like, I'm like, you make sure his voice, you pop. I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah. Bonds hits third. And he goes, no, it's not. So it kind of worked a little bit where he comes around third. Or like Scully's call of Kirk Gibson's home run off of Eck. He didn't say anything for like 45 seconds. He called it, you know, there she goes. And then he always tells the story. Then he went in the back of the booth at Dodger Stadium, got a cup of coffee, which I think, come on, man.
Yeah.
Who's doing that?
That's an embellishment.
No one's that cool. But it's me. If anybody could do it, he'd probably load up a pipe and, you know, have a little tea. Anyway.
It was taking Gibson a while around the bases, too.
Then he came back out with Edgar Allan Poe and, you know, in a line. Like, come on, man. You're a poet, man. Anyway, so when Bonds hit third, and I have reasonable, you know, confirmation that it's that guy, like, moments ago, Barry Bonds at legendary home run number 750. Dave was that his first year with the Giants full time? May have been first or second. He was crushed. It was a big moment. He was on the Today Show the next morning. You know, everybody wanted to talk to him. So the whole line was that I got on the ground and cut Dave's, you know, the cord of his mic right when Bonds hit it, and I'm stealing the home run, which I didn't do. So it was, I didn't realize it in the moment how big of a deal it was. The ultimate thing I remember, and my brother was a sportscaster in Philadelphia, my mentor, and he's since passed away. That night, he calls me, and he's just laughing. You get the biggest home run call in the history of baseball, and you ruined it. He's just killing me. I'm like, oh, thank you. So anyway, yeah, that was Dave and I have fun with that, and I bring it up with Hammer whenever I'm around him. I haven't seen you since you screwed Dave's call.
Well, he's gotten several big ones since then.
Oh yeah,
too.
I mean, so, Dave's one of them. Right? Dave's a good guy, but at the time, it was a big deal. Have you heard that call? I mean, you've heard all the big moments in Kipe's call, 756, you know, off of Bassick, you know, years later of Washington. So anyway, it was in the moment, it was one of those deals where you didn't know it was that big. It got big as time went on. Could you imagine that happening today in the world
with
we live
social
in?
Social media, oh, yeah. That would be amplified by millions of
views.
Yeah.
Which is why everything we do today is just too much.
And it's only been
overanalysis and everything.
20 years, which is crazy. How much
that what it was?
Yeah. It was
24.
In the mid-2000s.
I just saw Bonds the other day. I saw him at Ricky's Memorial.
He's been around a lot. He was at the All-Star
He coached the Rising Stars game with Jerry Rice and Barry. I mean, can you imagine those two egos in the same arena?
They had a little bit of a back and forth.
Jerry went up and gave him a little chest bump. So it struck me. I saw the rosters for that. I'm looking at the coaches. And, I mean, do you realize what we're talking about here? This is the home run king. And you can accuse him of whatever you wanted. But we saw him hit the ball over a fence 762 times. It did happen. And then Jerry, and I call Jerry's 200th touchdown in the NFL with the Raiders. It was in Denver against Mike Shanahan's team, the Broncos, on Monday Night Football. And what did Jerry get to, 209? So when we do a Mount Rushmore, a Bay Area athletes.
Those two guys have to be on.
Are they, though?
I mean,
you got Steph, Willie, and Joe. And then to me, it's always been one of the two.
So we're limiting Mount Rushmore to four?
Well, have you been to Mount Rushmore? There are four presidents? We're not going to count Trump's head. He doesn't count. So, even though I'm sure he's computer generated.
Yeah, Elon, you can add it with AI.
Elon probably did that for him.
But no, okay, I think it's four. Are we keeping it at four? Or are we gonna
yeah,
go
I mean, isn't it four? I think it's four presidents at Mount Rushmore.
So obviously,
he should know more than me, right?
Obviously, Joe and Jerry does have to get there too, because I think Jerry's the best football player ever. It's hard to differentiate between positions. But the statistical domination that we saw from Jerry Rice, the fact that he put
are
two
you familiar
or maybe
with Don Hutson of the Green Bay Packers?
Was before my time.
Well, I know you do a lot of research. You go back.
I am familiar with Don
Hutson.
He
dominated the wide receiver position in his era more so than
when
but
there
I would
wasn't
give
as
it
much
to
passing.
You. Jerry is the GOAT. I'm playing. But Don Hutson did dominate the wide receiver position as he was Gretzky. There are certain, you know, Ruth Gretzky did things. Statistically, they're like, what? Jerry did it consistently, the Triple Crown. Do you even know Ja'Marr Chase won the Triple Crown last year until it happened? Why didn't we get that, you know, for Offensive Player of the Year and Saquon and Lamar? I'm like, wait a minute. Ja'Marr Chase leads the NFL in receptions, yards, and touchdowns. That's only been done four times in the history of the NFL. Why don't we, and Jerry was one of the guys to do that in Cooper Kupp in 21. But Jerry, you know, was the best receiver in football for a long time.
The longevity.
Don Hutson just was Ruth or Gretzky. He took what was the norm. Like one year, Babe Ruth had more home runs than anybody else in the American League. Like, what? Who does that? So Hutson, because they didn't throw the ball back then.
Yes.
It was a different.
So relative to what else was
going on.
Yeah,
he dominated. But anyway. Jerry's Jerry. I'm just poking fun.
Well, you're talking about calling his games for the Raiders. And in 2002 Oakland,
he
had 1,200 receiving yards.
He was 40
years old.
869
receiving yards at 41.
Super Bowl, when we lost Super Bowl 37 to Tampa Bay, Jerry,
yeah.
Tim Brown. Can I swear on this again?
Yeah, go for
he
it.
Shit the bed. Tim Brown had a Debo game. He had a bad game. Jerry was unbelievable in that game. And Jerry...
That's at 40, right? At
he
age
was 40.
40
or 41.
41
it was 2002.
Yeah.
40. Yeah, he played in the Pro Bowl. Jerry, being around him those years, and, you know, he's worthy of it. He is. He's got a huge ego. So there's Bonds. And they should, you know, the home run king, the touchdown king. But because he was new to us, and, you know, the way it ended with the Niners, with T.O. having the 20 catches the last game, Jerry was, I remember sitting on the field in Alameda after a practice, and, you know, like director's chairs, like you and I are sitting. And we just went through the rock tree, and because he blew me away. He was so different than Tim Brown. Tim is just a broken field runner. It's a little like Debo. I see some commonalities in Debo and Tim Brown.
Interesting.
Where it's their ability to run after. It's not, Tim's genius is just feeling your body and where you are and sliding. And Jerry was, you know, everything was mapped out, choreography, dance steps. It was exactly, and he would, what was interesting to me was he, and I knew about it with the Niners, I'd read about it. Whenever he caught a 7-yard slant in practice, he'd run it 80 yards for a touchdown. And it was like, wow. After a while, I thought it was kind of annoying. Like, can we run the next play? What are you doing? Like, you're like holding up practice for a minute.
He was getting his condition.
But he just, it was what, but he, anyway, he was such a detailed, so he was Bill Walsh. You're not going to go to Bill Walsh and, you know, run a 12-yard dig or 18-yard dig and not run it at 18 yards or, you know, a three and out, whatever the route was. He was going to run it exactly the way it was supposed to be, or he'd get chewed out. He was raised that way. Where Tim came into the NFL from Notre Dame being a kick returner and hurt his knee. So anyway, being around Jerry and just the brilliance in his work ethic. Mm-hmm. Now, he had a huge ego. I remember there was a game against Buffalo where he did not catch a pass, and it snapped the streak. I forget, like,
you know, however many games in a row.
2 million games in a row. Jerry Rice caught a pass, 2-1, whatever it was. He was so mad. But the Raiders barely won the game. It was like 9-3. Bledsoe quarterback Buffalo. And it was like they couldn't make a first down, let alone get it. So after the game, Al goes, boy, Jerry's got a big ego. He's so mad that he didn't catch a pass. I'm like, what do you think, Al? He's Jerry Rice. Of course, but he was meticulous. You know, absolutely meticulous as a route runner. It was great to be around him.
That really, I've read a lot about Bill Walsh, especially recently. I'm reading the book called Genius on Bill Walsh, and the introduction.
The one his son wrote, or wait, there's many of them.
No, this was just an author. I forgot the author's name, but it's very well researched, and it goes through his entire life. But I'm at the spot now where they drafted Jerry Rice, and he discovered him. Bill Walsh discovered him before the 49ers played Houston, the Oilers. He was in a hotel room
watching on Saturday.
Yeah, some local TV highlights. But
right.
What you were saying about Rice bringing the work ethic, the standard that Bill wanted to the 49ers building, I think that's what allowed that dynasty to really form. They'd won two titles already, but this is what turned it into overdrive. And then what the 49ers did in 1989, 14-2, they beat the Broncos 55-10. That was perfection offensively. And I don't
think that wasn't his team.
I know it wasn't Bill's team. Yeah, he didn't get.
He should, though.
I think he gets credit for it. I think in colloquial circles. I think so.
Yeah.
It was the year after he left, right?
Yeah.
But you go back to finding Jerry Rice and Rice elevating that offense, essentially replacing Freddie Solomon, elevating that offense to a Hall of Fame level.
Well, let it know.
And I think you go back to the cultural impact that he had on that team. You talk about the work ethic. Yes, there's the ego involved, but the work ethic went to another level and others followed. And I think that's what Bill appreciated the most out of Jerry.
You know, I was obviously very close with Al, but I did games with Bill. I did Stanford games with Bill on ABC, and he would get all, as soon as they would break the huddle, he would get mad. He'd slam the table, and he didn't like the way they lined up, and then when the play started, he'd get mad. You know, you talk about the greatest football coaches that's ever been, and Belichick's had an amazing career. The 6 is a head coach, 2 is a defensive coordinator. Those two back-to-back games when he beat the Niners in the 90 NFC Championship game, and then the beat the Bills with the K-Gon offense in Super Bowl 25 are the two most masterful defensive game plans in the history of the sport. He took down the two best offenses back-to-back. So Belichick's in a different category. But to just omit Bill, even like Paul Brown, you know, what Paul Brown was able to do as an offensive mind, it all came from Paul Brown. But Bill, look at the league now. It's all Bill. and what he was able to establish with that short passing game. The crime in it was he waited so long to get a chance to be a head coach.
Yeah.
He didn't, and it crushed him. And Al talked to me a lot about it. The perception was he was weak. He wasn't a tough guy.
It was a different era of football. Yeah.
So Paul Brown hires Tiger Johnson, not Bill. Bill's crushed. You know, leave it to Eddie and that, you know, Bill did work for the Raiders, you know, one time. He was with the Raiders in the late 60s. So Al always had a great love for him. But his offensive genius, you could see it. I mean, it was just different football. The AFL would throw the ball deep down the field. They had their own way of playing with Sid Gilman, Don Coryell, obviously. But Bill, the way he incorporated the short passing game and the running backs and the tight ends in the passing game was genius. And he ran the league. What hurt him was he got hired late and he was nuts. He was just too emotional. The Anthony Carter loss in 87 when the Vikings beat him. And then the 88 season, the next year, they ultimately won the Super Bowl, but he was out of his mind. They had a loss to the Raiders middle of the year.
9-3.
Dropped him to 6-5.
Mike Shanahan.
Yeah. It was a 9-3, whatever.
9-3.
Yeah, I mean, I think he either was fired after that game or quit. I mean, I have to ask Eddie. Then they essentially ran the table, won the Super Bowl. His last play call is genius, where he lines up John Taylor as a tight end position. He's not even the primary on there. Anyway, and then he just... For what he was like for me a little bit back then, they were so wrapped up in what they did that he quit or whatever it was. He didn't come.
So that's where the stress.
Now, Steve, that was Bill's team. Well, you know, the record book show it was Seifert, and a lot of the players do speak to they wanted to show they could win without Bill. There was a little bit of that because he was hard on players. But that the 89 team is arguably one of the best Niner teams, that in 84, and one of the best teams of all time.
They had the greatest outscored their opponents by 100 points in the postseason.
What Philadelphia just did in the championship game of the Super Bowl was amazing. It wasn't what the Niners did
in 89.
In those two games. They won that game 55-10. So, Seifert doesn't get into the Hall because of the shadow of Bill Walsh. But Bill, just when you think of the greatest I put Belichick as the greatest defensive coach of all time. And then there'd be many for consideration for offensive, but it would be Bill and Paul Brown. Paul Brown modernized the game.
So poetic, too, that Bill's first Super Bowl came
against the Bengals.
Cincinnati,
and
yeah.
And they beat him again. Him twice.
Yeah, beat him again for his last one.
And then the other one was against Don Shula and Dan Marino, which is one of the greatest games of all time. The greatest
Bill believes that was the best performance that he ever coached.
The
Stanford Stadium Miami game against Marino, where a lot of the discourse leading up into that game was like the discourse you see today. The big, strong quarterback is going to dominate no matter what. But it was, Joe was fantastic in that game. But the totality of the team effort that the 49ers put in that 84 Super Bowl was something else.
Well, Marino was, and I saw Dan play at Pitt. And I was at Syracuse. We broadcasted their games. In his junior year, he was as dominant as any college football player ever.
So you were a student broadcaster and you got to see Marino?
Yeah, I broadcast the games, yeah.
Okay.
At WAER, I was the sports director of the Syracuse.
So you travel everywhere?
Well, we didn't make every road trip. I was a sports director, so I divvied out the assignments my junior and senior year. We also had the AAA rights to the Toronto Blue Jays team, the Syracuse Chiefs. So I did 2 years of AAA baseball between my sophomore and junior year at Syracuse and my junior and senior year. So I did hundreds of baseball games.
So you were way ahead of the curve.
So I was hired by the Indiana Pacers when I was 21. I was hired directly out of college. I'm the youngest full-time play-by-play announcer in American sports history. Now I'm the oldest, which sucks.
Anyway, I don't think you're quite there yet, you'll probably hold that youngest title.
I'm going to live off him. So what were we talking about?
We were talking about you calling Dan Marino's games.
So Marino was, Marino's junior year was, and then he had issues off the field, a lot of rumors about him, and he wound up sliding to 25. Al took Don Mosbar at center before him.
Don Mosbar.
Don Mosbar.
Mount Whitney High School. Yeah. Visalia, California.
What was Visalia? That's my high school. What was the outstanding characteristic of him?
Don Mosbar, very tall.
6'4", 6'5", center.
He led Mount Whitney to glory in the Cowhide game against Redwood High School.
He was drafted by the Raiders. Then went to the Raiders.
He was a great player.
He played a long time. Centers typically aren't that big. They're 6'1", 6'2". Mm-hmm. Mosbar, because, you know, getting down, down up when they're under center. Anyway, Marino was so good. That year, I remember him. I was in Buffalo for a game just watching it. I think he played against the Raiders off the bench, or his first start was against the Raiders. But one of his first game action was against the Bills. And he was, it's just, you never saw a guy throw a ball. I saw Namath when I was a kid. I mean, Namath was, he just flick his wrist and the ball. He had no knees. He didn't stride. The ball would just soar in the air. Marino was more, you know, 18-yard digs to Duper and Clayton. It was boom. The ball came out fast. But he was, I mean, that year he threw for 5,084 yards and 48 touchdowns. His first full year as a starting quarterback, like Mahomes in 2019. His first year he was for 5,050.
And those days, too.
Obliterated the record.
Yes.
So going into that game, it was Marino and the Marx Brothers. Niners defense smoked him. The thing that's interesting about that game, and I've watched that game back on YouTube a few times, that's where the no-huddle offense really started. Miami used it, you know, like every team does, two-minute warning, end of games, end of halves. But they jumped into it early in that Super Bowl, before Sam Weiss did it with the sugar huddle in Cincinnati, and obviously Buffalo made it their mainstay with the K-gun in Buffalo during their championship runs to Super Bowls. But they jumped into it early. They actually took the lead in the game. They threw a touchdown pass to the tight end. Joe had that amazing touchdown pass to Carl Monroe. You ever question Joe's arm strength? Watch that throw. Yeah. Roll into his right, and he's like, wow.
And Roger Craig went crazy that game, too.
He could have been the MVP. Anyway, so that's one of my favorite Super Bowls. I was actually doing the Indiana Pacer games then. My car went dead. I could hardly watch the game. I had to watch it. But anyway, that was Joe Montana against Dan Marino, and it was Bill Walsh against Don Shula. So, I mean, that one always gets kind of swept away. But anyway, Walsh won 3, and 2 were against the Bengals, Paul Brown's team. And the other was against Shula, the winningest coach of all time.
And 2 were without Jerry Rice. And then that's what supercharged the dynasty. And unfortunately, Bill wasn't there for that fourth one. But
so he only won the one with Rice, huh?
He won 88. One with Rice in 88. And Rice took over that game, but it was Taylor who scored the winning touchdown. Rice had a couple huge catches on that final drive.
He was MVP of the game, yeah.
Yep. And then obviously 94 happened. That was the last time that the 49ers have won a Super Bowl. That came in Miami again. There's a lot of Miami Super Bowls.
I'm well aware.
I have to ask you, you know, you talk, I called student radio games for Stanford back when Harbaugh and Luck were there, and I got to travel. That was a cool start to my sports journalism career. Going back, what was your first football call? What was your first call in general over at Syracuse?
Wow. When I got there, the Carrier Dome opened. Mm-hmm. So the very first play, I was in broadcasting then. I was a freshman. We had a procedure how to get on the air. I would sit in the crowd with Sean McDonough, one of the great voices of ABC. He's going to do Canada USA on Thursday night. He was my roommate, and we would sit in the crowd in the Carrier Dome. I have a tape recorder, and you had to have a demo tape, and then the sports director would clear you. Ultimately, I became the sports director. And with Sean's boss.
Because it's hyper-competitive.
It is. I mean, there were a lot of good, you know, Mike Tirico was there, Sean, Bill Roth, Dan Hoard, the voice of the Bengals. A lot of pain, obviously. Marv Albert, Dick Stockton.
So you're sitting there in the crowd announcing the game?
Yeah, just to get on the air. We weren't actually on the air. The first play in that dome was Joe Morris, who had a great career with the New York Giants, ran back the opening kickoff 95 yards for a touchdown. I remember the first time we had to get cleared even to do like morning sportscast. We'd have to get up and you know, be on the air at 6 a.m. I'd be on M Street till 4:30 in the morning and then roll right over there. First time I heard my voice back through my headsets, it was like, it just threw me. I was terrible.
It freaks you out. Yeah.
I was not, Sean was an absolute natural. The moment he put them on, he was just Vin Scully.
He just
spoke beautifully. And I couldn't do it. But it is a learned behavior. I tell people I can, you know, as long as you have the work ethic and you want to look, you know, spend the time, we can diagram a court or a field or an ice rink and teach you how to call it. So it is a learned behavior. But to answer your question, so all these years later, I really hadn't done football. I did it in college, but then I was hired into the NBA and I did baseball. I didn't do football. I did LA Rams preseason games one year on TV.
What year was that?
John Robinson. I want to say late 80s, mid 80s.
Irv Pankey.
Irv Pankey.
I went to high school with his two sons.
Yeah, that was John Robinson. He was very, anyway, so when it came time to get the Raiders job, they didn't want to hire me because I had no football tape to give them. I think I gave them that Rams preseason game. Oh, you know what I did? I did a bunch of football on TV, like for ESPN. I did it with Jack Snow, like Fresno State, San Jose State. We did a Big West Conference.
Bulldog Stadium?
Yeah, I went there a lot. Jim Sweeney and all those. There was some great matchups.
Good years. Was that before or after Dilfer? Probably a little bit before.
It was during. It was
during
before. I think I may overlap with Dilfer. It was Aaron Craver and Lorenzo Neal. Dilfer was there. He was the quarterback. Go back, even San Jose State had Mike Perez and Hesh Kolar, the safety, and Guy Liggins, wide receiver. Anyway, I get hired to the Raiders in 97. They didn't want to hire me. They wanted to hire Bruce McGowan. Mm. Anyway, because Al, he had all the old Raider tapes. Anyway, we had to convince him. Al, because I went to Syracuse, went along with it, and then Al and I became very close. He's my second father. But the very first Raider preseason game I did was in Dallas against the Cowboys. And I was so bad. I sucked. It was just so hard. It was just football had changed so much. The situational even in the preseason game, the substitutions, the every down, there's new. And in preseason, it's even worse. I'd worried so much about, you know, the players and knowing, you know, how they play and all that, that I hadn't thought about how am I actually going to call the game. And I hadn't done it on radio since I left Syracuse.
So were you just losing track of
I remember going up to Allen, Bruce Allen, after the game on the flight home and said, I fucking suck today. And I will never be like that again. I don't know if I was sitting or whatever. The way I do it now, I stand the entire game. And I attack it with my eyes and senses like I'm playing middle linebacker or free safety. You just got to open, you got to see everything. I wasn't proactive. The game was riding me. I was behind it all. It was brutal. The very next game, we came back home to play Green Bay in the preseason, and that was much better. The first time I did that was the one game where I just was humbled. This is hard. It's like, because football, you know, when Bill King did it and Bill was giving me pointers, they didn't sub as much. They occasionally went to a three wide receiver package. Mike Siani went in the slot and the East formation, but it was Biletnikoff and Branch and they didn't move around a lot. You know, now, especially in a preseason game, like who's the quarterback? You know, Aikman's going to take one series to be out and who is it, Jason Garris? I don't know. It took me a while. Football, especially on the radio, when I do it on television, like in the preseason, we do TV that are not on national games. It's more of a sit back and analyze and watch if you're doing it on, the way at least I do it is you really have to attack the game, otherwise you're behind. I hate being behind the call. I hate hearing throws, touchdown, you know, it's got to be throws, caught, you know, and then the crowd. You got to beat it. He was asking me about the first time it was that game in 97 at Texas Stadium in Irving was a humbling night.
And it sounds like that really influenced your career in as this is how I get ready for a game now. You treat it like a middle linebacker, like a player. I see you now before every game, and it does seem that you have a consistent routine, because I can I have my routine. I like to cover the game from being on my toes, not on my heels, and I'm not even calling the game. I need to be ready on
social media.
Yeah. I got to watch, and I'm going to react with my video shortly thereafter. Then I want to write the best article. So I have this dedicated routine, and it always... But this is by accident. Whenever you join my live, like, it's not that I planned that. It's because we're in the same spot at the same time before every game. So I see your routine. Now I want to ask you about it. What is that game day routine?
What you see is the final piece, which is right before kickoff.
But you're getting mentally locked in.
But I study mainly the other team when I'm doing that, because I've watched us all week in practice. And I just like to watch certain idiosyncrasies of the way the players run. A lot of it is for the talk show, and, you know, there's so much around the games. Like, when we go to the combine and analyze the players, you can learn a lot by, like, Cooper Kupp. Anyway, my routine starts, you know, right after the game is played on Sunday. I take a little break and rewatch the game back Sunday night a couple times for my own, to do the talk show. And then I'll watch the All 22 and but basically by Tuesday, I'm done with the previous game, and now I'm on to the new team. So the generation that I'm in now is video. It's so much easier. Like, you know, Bill King, Lon Simmons, Don Klein, Joe Starkey. When I was doing the Raiders, I used to travel with this gray duffel bag filled with VHS tapes. Or not filled, but I'd have four or five tapes from the other team. The Raiders would get me a VHS in my hotel room. The hotel, a lot of times, thought I was a coach. So there'd be a whiteboard in there. And, you know, there'd be a, you know, all kinds
TV
of stuff.
I didn't need. You're watching?
Yeah. No. I didn't need all I needed was the VHS, and it was the old school beta. So I would watch. You know, my generation, we've always had video. Like, when I remember asking Bill, like, you know, how did you memorize the Miami Dolphins? He'd be like, I'd have it in my car, and I have a rostered, I'd be driving along and stop at a red light in Sausalito, and Howard Twilley wears number 81. So I know it's Howard Twilley and Warfield's 42. So it was, that would scare me. Even when I do there were years I did a high school game on Thursday, a Cal or Stanford game on Saturday, and a Raider game on Sunday. The high school games were by far the most difficult because there's no video. I would often drive to the school or the coach's house, or he'd bring it to me. I just got to see how they run. Like, how do they play? How do you line? What's your shell? So the process is just, I read everything. The Niners send me clips, and during the season, they could be 100 pages long. But I also get John Kingdon, who's a very good friend, was L. Davis's director of scouting, sends me what's called For Your Eyes Only, which is the compilation of the clips of the entire league. So the team we're playing, I will get their newspaper clips, like 30 pages. So I read, you know, everything that's going on. But basically, the process involves watching. I watch, I try to watch, and it's harder later in the year. But even, you know, week 12, right up until kickoff, I may have watched every game that team's played. I've at least had it on, and I'm listening. I'll watch the All 22, but I also listen to the broadcasters, and I'll read about a play that happened. And I'll be like, well, when did that come up? And then, so it's just a process. And it makes it, again, we do a lot more than just call the game. We're constantly giving our opinion on players. And you want to trade for that guy? Do you want to sign that guy? Do you want to cut that guy? You want to draft that guy? So it's a lot of that. But it's also, as you know, because you studied the game as well as I do, and you do it expertly, is it helps just, you know, teams have tendencies how they line up and play. So when I'm actually calling a play, I may not, I'll have a working knowledge where Puka Nacua and Cooper Kupp line up, where Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison, they never moved. Reggie Wayne was always right, or pardon me, always right was Marvin Harrison. Reggie Wayne was always left. They never motioned. So, I mean, you just find out things like, how does this team play? And then more so defensively, offensively, you know, I pretty much know every player in the league offensively. How do they line up? Who's their nickel? Who's their big nickel? What's their
How do they rotate? Who's their outside corner? Is it a boundary corner? So when I have to call the play, I can call it. Even if I not necessarily saw exactly who made the catch, I'll have an idea based on formation. Tim is great at this, my partner, Tim Ryan, mm-hmm. Especially with a Kyle Shanahan team. I like to be able, when the huddle is broken and we're coming up, both teams, you like to set where the five eligibles are.
Yes.
And what they're going to do. The essence of pro football, and this is why it's a lot like basketball to me, where pro football, you have five offensive linemen, left tackle to right tackle. You have a quarterback. So those are basically your pawns if we're playing chess, the offensive lineman. The quarterback is generally a stationary object. He generally lines up in the midline. Now he can be in the shotgun, he can be in the pistol, he can be under center, but he's generally behind the center. And some quarterbacks run more, so they're a queen. Some are more stationary, so they're a king. But basically, you have five linemen and a quarterback that are pretty consistent. It's how you use the other five eligibles that set you, who you are as an offense.
Yep.
And to me, that's basketball. That's five offensive players, but we're not covering them five on five. If we're rushing four, we have seven other defenders to cover the five. If we blitz a fifth, then we're covering six over five.
Yes.
And then if we change the math of the five linemen, we're rushing four, where we're going to block five over four. But if we're bringing a fifth, now it's five over five. But what if you bring a full, you know, somebody stays? So the point is that, and that's what's Kyle Shanahan's genius, and it's what makes football what it is today, where before it was a pro set, which was a halfback and a fullback. And a lot of times in the 70s, they were level. Quarterback was under center. Larry Zonka and Jim Kick were behind. They weren't offset. They were both, you know, 5 yards behind to the each side. Now, you know, you could put, you know, an offset eye. You could empty the fullback out. You empty the back. The quarterback's not under center. He's in the shotgun. He's in the pistol. You're in a wildcat. You're moving. The tight end moves in motion. So that, to me, is the preparation is like the Rams run, you know, Puka Nacua is always going in jet sweep motion. But he doesn't go in jet sweep motion necessarily to take a handoff. He could take a handoff and run a jet sweep. He could continue in the flat and get 3 yards into the flat. Or he could run like he's going out and then turn back and insert himself behind the guard and be another blocker. I mean, that's what Bill Walsh did with Jerry. I call it yo-yo motion,
yes.
Where the receiver goes in motion. They did it with Rice. How do you get to cover Jerry Rice? He goes in motion behind the offensive line. He crosses the tackle, turns, and comes back the other direction. And now when the ball's snapped, he's hidden behind the guard and tackle. Well, who's going to cover him? He's going to get a clean release out. And that's what Mike McDaniel
and
the exit motion, the cheat motion.
Yes, yeah.
So it's all... So that, to me, is what, you know, I want to call all that. And I think fans, you know, sometimes I think, am I just bombarding them with all these words and they don't know what's there? It's too much. But when you watch the game, aren't you watching for that? And then who follows them? Are they playing a zone or a man? How are they covering that? That is really the essence. And then what personnel group they're in. Are they in 21, which is two backs, one tight end, or 12, one back, two tight ends, or 11, which is three wide receivers? Then the defense, that's the essence of pro football, is what formation, what personnel group the offense is in. You see the teams on the sideline, the defensive coaches, and in practice, that's all they ever yell, 11, 11, 11. That means three wide receivers yep. are in the game, one running back, one tight end. Mm-hmm. So what do you play against 11, a nickel defense? You're not going to put three linebackers out there. So that's the beauty of what Kyle Shanahan does with someone like Kyle Juszczyk, because he's an ultimate.
Whatever.
Now we're getting into the five eligibles. Now it's all blurred. Your fullback's not really a fullback.
Positionless skill position.
Your halfback, McCaffrey's not a halfback. He'll line up in the slot. Your Debo, your Z-back, runs, goes in the backfield, takes a handoff. We're not an 11 personnel. Debo's not a wide receiver. He's a running back. So now you got all these small guys out there, and we're going to run it.
Yeah, you're going to run
on nickel. That's the game I'm trying to, you know, relay to people that I think. And there's such a sophisticated, well, the way you break down tape things you've done for years and the way you analyze it and then what all the different shows. I think fans are, this generation, my kids' generation of viewing football has been much more educated than I was. It's just because there's more going on.
And I think that you said you're conveying a lot of information, but you only have a very finite amount of time. This stuff happens quickly. And I think that especially when I've called games or when I'm just trying to react to a play and I don't have a lot of time, I think I filter out the extraneous stuff. And naturally, the way that I view the game and the way that I speak about it, and I think when I listen to your calls, you do the same thing, you bring what actually is relevant. So yeah, there could be a lot of terminology, but in order for you to get on with the call and you know conceptualize the game properly in your own head, yeah, I think you've done a good job sorting what is important for the fan to listen to.
Yeah, it's probably, you probably really have to pay attention, you know, to understand it.
But people that detail.
I mean, if you're invested to listen to a game on the radio, I would think you would be. You're not a casual fan. And then just, if I can see Puka Nacua, say, coming in motion, my eyes may go, when the ball snapped, to Stafford looking left to Cooper Kupp, and then he comes back to the right, I have a pretty good idea that's got to be Nacua, right? Who else could that be? It could be Tyler Higbee. The tight end may have flared out. But so, sometimes I'll pick up the identification of the player later. I don't like to do that. I like to say Stafford throws caught by Nacua.
It sounds terrible. Whenever you're listening, the worst is when somebody is so unprepared that they call it the number. Number 15 call. That's amateur stuff. I understand that.
One of the greatest to ever do it was a guy named Lindsey Nelson. And Lindsey did San Francisco Giants games. He was most probably well known for Notre Dame football and the New York Mets. But he would do Monday Night Football, and he had this very distinctive voice. And you know, like the Jets are playing it's Namath. So he'd be like, Namath throws, caught by 88, caught by 88 Markham, caught by 88 Jerome Markham. And it'd be like, he went right down the roster. He saw 88, where if you don't know, 88's Michael Irvin, move on. So it's like that would bother me. If you ever hear me say throws caught by number 4, it's time to retire me.
So I fully agree, but I also agree with your original point. The next worst thing is saying it's caught, and then maybe it's just that I'm overly critical when I listen because I called some of these games, but if it takes a few seconds for the announcer to say the name, I know that he's looking down on his sheet trying to figure out who it was. And that means you haven't watched enough tape.
Yeah.
That means you don't know the tendencies. You're reacting on your heels instead of being on your toes.
But but that's what we are because we're perfectionists. Gotten into in moments, and this is where it's mainly usually defensive players. Mm-hmm. If an offensive player catches the ball, sometimes you get fooled by a tight end number and a wide receiver.
Yeah, yes, like, those are the exceptions.
Like, who's that? Like, for a second, you just like go brain dead. Like, I've done so many games. If you get a defensive player with a pick six, that's where it's challenging. And I try to be on that. But there have been moments where there's a moment of terror, like I don't know exactly who that is, or you make the ultimate mistake is misidentify someone. You think you see half a number, and mm-hmm. you're so preoccupied with doing what satisfies Papa and Lombardi that we give the wrong name. That's worse. But there have been moments where a guy's running for a touchdown, and I'm like, there's a moment of terror, like, who is it?
And you better get it right. Well, you know what, though? Say his name.
At that moment, just call the play.
Yeah, and if then, you're not sure.
Because I listen to other people, and sometimes it's intercepted by the Eagles or, you know, they're running back, and we'll figure out the name later. Like, sometimes I get, like, lost in myself, and you get scared. Like, I just botched this call, and I didn't identify him right away. And then you might end up making a mistake. Like, well, you know, the immaculate reception. Bill King called Franco Harris Frenchie Fuqua. He had the wrong guy catching the ball out of the air because the ball was thrown to Frenchie.
Well, thankfully, now, that would didn't catch it either.
We all make mistakes. It's hard. It's going fast. I remember Darian Gordon, the Raider defensive back, intercepted a ball, ran it back for a touchdown against Carolina. They got to 50, and I called him the wrong name. So, I mean, it's a quick score on defense. It's challenging. And then you get a defensive lineman scoops up the ball. You're like, who the hell's that guy? Why is he touching the ball? But in your desire to be perfect, sometimes you make more errors than you should. And just just the point that is the Niners scooped and scored a touchdown. And we'll figure out who did it later.
And then you can always let the crowd breathe a little bit and
right,
figure
and then
out
come
exactly
back to
who it was.
And then I'll hit the cough back and who the fuck scored that touchdown?
And I hope the cough button worked that time.
Oh, you're on the air, Greg. Oh, sorry. And I have done that. I have sworn on the air.
How were you sure during the Bonds home run call when I guess there was some profanities being exchanged back and forth that you weren't
no,
on
I didn't
the
swear.
Air?
I wouldn't swear.
I thought you said you might. What, when
no, I don't
know.
I'd swear probably more than I should, but I try not to. I have sworn twice on a live mic, unknowingly.
During a game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For different reasons.
For different reasons. Okay.
Yeah. Well, when I was doing the Raiders, I don't know how we're getting into this story. The Denver Broncos were 13-0, or maybe 12-0, going to New York to get to 13-0. They were behind the whole game. And excuse me, Mike Shanahan, but I was a Raider then. And they're down the whole game. They come back. Shannon Sharp, who I didn't like personally or as a player. Anyway, he makes this incredible touchdown catch to put the Broncos ahead with like 4 minutes to go. So I didn't know anything of it, but I'm reading the newspaper a couple days later, and it said a voice that sounded a lot like Greg Papa's dropped an F-bomb on the air. So I'm like, what did I say? So I got a copy of a tape. It's hilarious. So you hear like a commercial, and then it comes back, and it's dead air. And you hear me saying, that motherfucker. And then it's like, beat, beat. And then I said, moments ago in New York, two-time Pro Bowl tight end Shannon Sharp made an incredible touchdown. It was like, I didn't know I was back. So you're trying to be careful. Anyway.
No 49ers moments. Yeah, I like that. Since 2019?
Where I've sworn on the air? No. Well, yeah. Well, the pandemic year. Wow. Was that,
that
a challenge?
Count. Yeah.
So the first...
the crowd
to do,
is
we,
quiet, too.
No, we had to do road games when the team was not... We didn't travel.
Oh, so you called it from the studio.
I could, called it from Levi's.
Watching the game on the stream?
Watching the game. So the first game... So what was the opener that year? We lose to Arizona.
Arizona then went to the Jets.
Kyler Murray went to the Jets.
Met Death
so
Stadium.
I remember that first game, I call Al Guido, the Niner president, and I'm like, we're going to kick off for the new season. There's no one in the stands. I'm like, why are we doing this? This is so weird. So that was, at least the players were in front of me in the same stadium.
Yeah.
I was not allowed to travel. To be around the team, I had to take a COVID test every single day and stay in even away. And Robert Saleh come up with his mask off talking to me. I'm like, go away. I don't want to stay over there. So anyway, the first game, it's a 10 a.m. kickoff in California. We're playing the Jets. We get there early. And we do the same show, same game. Only we're in the booth, the Lon Simmons broadcast booth. The game's in New Jersey. First of all, at 10 o'clock in the morning, the glare in early September, mid-September, is coming through the glass where we're like in an atrium. I'm like, I can't. So we had to like put up Mike Baird and Mike Holler, put up, you know, like cardboard boxes to try to block the glare. So then we're supposed to get the feed like we do for every game. We get the monitor. And they also gave us the all 22, or really it's the all 29, because you get all the players and the seven officials. So you can see like the clock and just the way it was hard. The game's not in the stadium. So we're doing it off a monitor. I've never done this before. So it's 9:58, you know, the captains are out for the to coin toss. It's 9:59. I'm like, where's the monitor? Nothing. We're not getting anything at all. So, you know me, I have like four different iPads. So I start pulling out I use the iPads for stats and everything, but now I'm like, I got to get the game. So I fire up whatever device to watch the game. So I get two going. I give one to Tim Ryan, my partner, and then I'm firing up my other one, like on the opening kickoff, I'm like doing it. So Tim's iPad was ahead of mine by like 30 seconds.
What a disaster.
So for the first play of the game, remember the first play of the game?
The Raheem Mostert
80-yard touchdown. Yeah. You're good. So. My iPad, I'm literally now just getting it up.
Is Tim yelling pretty
So Tim says, so I go, and the Niners break the huddle and Garoppolo goes into the, and you know, Mostert's the tailback, and Tim goes, And I'm like, well, I guess it's going to be an easy call. I guess it's Bing.
Yeah.
So it's 18 Toss to the right.
Yeah.
I'm like, Foster, cheers. So we laughed. So his iPad was 30 seconds ahead of mine.
So you guys are literally watching off YouTube TV and broadcasting the game.
I didn't even have YouTube. I think it was NFL, my app or Reds. I don't know what it was. I don't know when we got it back, but that was insane. So I didn't swear, but I was like, you kidding me?
You probably also knew that Nick Bosa tore his ACL 30 seconds before it happened.
The span of three snaps.
Solomon Thomas
cart, Bosa. Nick Bosa cart.
A couple snaps before or after that, Jimmy, ankle sprain.
They won the game anyway. And you went to, where'd they go to?
They stayed there. They played the Giants the next
week. No, but
week.
They went to like... to Youngstown or Morgantown? Where did they go to?
The West Virginia one.
They went to the one White with Sulphur crazy, Springs, yeah.
Yeah, the one with the crazy wallpaper.
West Virginia,
hotel.
Mountain Mama. I didn't go. Were you allowed to go on that?
No, but they went again, I think, the next year. They did that 2 years in a row.
Yeah, I never went. Anyway, it was...
I'm so sorry. I just want to make sure we have time for portraits and everything. So maybe we do final questions. Is that okay? Or did you have a lot more?
Yeah, sure.
We haven't even talked about the Niners.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
All right.
We can wrap up just talking a little bit about, you brought the hat in here.
Well, I brought this for you.
You
so
did?
This is, Guy Haberman gave me this.
Guy Haberman has good merchandise.
So it's 262, which is the guy. It's also the number of wins Justin Verlander has. So he's 38 away from 300. But for our guy, it's Brock Purdy.
We'd hope, Giants fans will hope that number
goes to 300. You think it'll stay long enough to be a...
Well, at least... They hope that it doesn't stay at 262.
We'll have to get a new hat every time he wins a game.
It changes.
But Brock will be forever
262.
262. And the evolution of Brock, and we saw it from, literally his first OTAs, the first training camp practices, his first preseason game against the Packers when he had the game winner going to his right, the two-point conversion, the way he ran the clock down, then going to Minnesota and those joint practices in Eagan. And I remember watching him on the field standing behind the offense with Mike Shanahan. And Mike's a little guy, played quarterback. And I'm smaller than both, but I'm like, how does Brock see? It was amazing to watch Brock just slide. And
the way he can angle his body.
But it was the way he processed. And then to see the success he's had. And it's, what I thought of him right away. Kawakami got all mad at me when I... said he was going to beat out Nate Sudfeld. Where's Nate now? And that
Is
was
he
a
on
weird.
Roster now?
And then Trey just struggled. It was just Trey just he had some good moments in that preseason. Where Trey got sideways was the finger injury against the Raiders. But anyway, Brock becomes the Brock star, big brain Brock, and the year he's had. And now, so the 262. And Cam Inman wrote this, but I was talking about it on the radio. So what if they gave him $262 million? So the question would be,
how many years?
How many years?
If they could sign him in 10 years, like...
Not 26, but if you did it for... If you gave him $262 for six years. And now he's in the low 40s. I've already did like 41.2, whatever it is. So if you give him $262 for six, he's going to make low 40s. If he does it for 5 years, it's 52. If he does it for four, then you're Dak, and they're not going to do that. So the question would be,
Dak over four would be 65.5.
Yeah, they're not going to do it. So it's just a fun number because he was the last pick in the draft. He's Mr. Irrelevant. They're not going to do it, but it would be. And I know how much you believe in him, and I do too. But I think there's reason to be a little concerned about his play this past year. I think Brock would tell you, and I know obviously not having McCaffrey and. Not having Ayuk for most of it, and Debo being largely ineffective. What did they score, 40 touchdowns together in 23? What did they get to last year, three?
I think it was three between
for
those
For most
guys.
Of the year, it was two.
Yeah.
McCaffrey, none. Ayuk, none. Debo had the one early and the one in Seattle, and then got one later against Miami.
He made poor choices at times where
the ball should go. And no matter who your five eligibles are, you still got an X, a Z, an F, a Y, and a H, and guys are open. Like the play, and I think what was concerning a little bit, when they go through the season, and Brian Griese and Clay and Kyle, they look at every frame, every snap. The way the Minnesota game went, how it was difficult for him to read that defense. And they were a great defense.
Especially early in the season.
Early in the year. But he had seen them the year before, you know, going there for the Monday night game. And there was one, he was having a hard time deciphering who was coming, who wasn't. It was hard. The one play was first and goal on the 5-yard line, and he boots to his left. And he's got Ayuk wide open in the left corner. And he was on the right hash, whereas where the ball was, the roll went left. I remember the play. It was right. Remember, they went for it on fourth down to Jennings, and it got slapped away. But the play on first down, where he just needed to get the ball out of his hand, you know, whether he couldn't see it or he wasn't comfortable flipping his hips and his shoulders, and that play, you know, I'm picking out moments. But there were some of these in just about every game. The Ram game, when the big comeback, remember Ayuk was wide open when they busted the coverage.
And week three, right?
Yeah, they lost week two. Yeah. Now if Ronnie Bell catches the ball,
then you're not talking
about
it. Kick
a field goal, we win. But he had Ayuk. We could see it from our vantage point in the end zone there. And he just didn't pull the trigger on it.
It just didn't seem that the rapport with Ayuk, which had been top-notch in 2023,
totally,
was there.
Oh, there was. Which leads to, like, so our broadcast booth, and I watch them all back on the All-22, mm-hmm, but sometimes even the quality of the tape is just, you don't see as enough as when you're doing it live. So we were doing a game in Washington. What was it? New Year's Eve. They won that game. Philadelphia lost Arizona, and we won the number one seed. Remember that game? And Brock didn't have a great game. I don't think he played it really his best football after the Baltimore game on Christmas night. I thought he struggled in that game, and then it continued. But anyway, there was one out route that Ayuk ran, and our broadcast booth in Washington's in the end zone, which is sometimes hard to see. Are you there too?
It's impossible to see.
It's hard to see the other side of the field, but there's certain things you see clear.
You can see the routes develop a little bit.
And you see it
better
than watching the All-22 because it's your own eyes.
Yes.
And we were at a little overhang. I could just, and he would throw, and I remember interviewing him after the game because he didn't play the week against the Rams, the last game. So I sat with him, and there was one out route to Ayuk, and I remember it so well that Ayuk was just in the stem of his route, and Brock just, and he just turned, and phew, and it was like, wow. It was a simple route, but the way they did it a lot, there was definitely that disconnect. But with the choices of where the ball, like the, you know, the first and goal on the 5 in Minnesota and the roll, he didn't see Ayuk, and they were both Ayuk early in the year. The deep shot, and Ayuk, that has nothing to do with them not being together. They busted the coverage. Ayuk was wide open. It was going to be a bomb, touchdown. And then one in Miami, there was a little choice route. Remember to Patrick Taylor over the middle? And it almost got intercepted. It was like, but I could see, like, where are you going with the ball? I think it was Juszczyk ran a rail route, or somebody was out to the right.
Didn't Taylor blame himself on that one, though?
But
he said he ran the wrong
depth. Ball, he was in and out covered, and it was lucky. Yeah, I mean, McCaffrey may have caught it, but right away I went, where are you going with the ball? It doesn't go there. So there were, again, we're nitpicking. Any quarterback, Mahomes, there's many times you watch Mahomes back. Like, why did he go there? It's hard. But that was the brilliance of Brock, was he was able to process it. I call him Big Brain Brock. He just invariably, the ball went where it should go. He didn't make mistakes. This past year, it didn't go as often to where it should have been. And then when he missed high a lot. The ball got tipped. The issue with him is his size. He's 6'5", 1/8 inch tall, and that's why he was picked 262 and not 62. If he was 6'3", 6'4". The issue with the gripping of the ball and weather, even in the Bay Area in playoff games, the Green Bay game, he had a hard time controlling the ball in that divisional. Put a glove on. I love Brock. I'm not saying he's not, but this past year, you have to be honest and say there was a stat I saw early in the year that blew me away. And it was, I think, the first 50 games a player, maybe it was 25, and then, anyway, the Niners with Brock Purdy at quarterback were the highest scoring team in the history of pro football. And more than Tom Brady. It was early this year. Higher than Tom Brady's Patriots, Patrick Mahomes' Chiefs, Dan Fouts' Chargers, Drew Brees' Saints. Any team that's ever had a quarterback play quarterback, it was almost 30 points a game. Remember, 30 for Purdy. And I was like, when I saw that, I was like, damn, that was say no more. I mean, I know you're so great with your graphs and numbers. And
that's simple.
The ultimate thing is that scoreboard.
Yep.
It doesn't matter if we have 50 first downs and we have one touchdown, we lose. You got to move the scoreboard.
Yep.
And Brock Purdy did that. But, you know, Jimmy's, the 2019 year, the Niners were second in the NFL in scoring.
9 points a game. 9.9, I think.
Almost 30, right yeah. behind Lamar.
Yeah.
So, and then, but this past year, so this year, it was early in the year. When I saw that stat, it was one of Tom Brady's first games because Fox sent me the packet. I was like, and I asked Kyle about it. I'm like, that's all that, you know. And with the Niners defense, we scored 30. You know, when they're right, they should be giving up 14, yeah. 17, not 27. So it all snowballed. And that, obviously, the special teams, the defense being as poor as it was, creates pressure.
It's all connected.
I'm not saying he's an island. He's not a starting pitcher. Right? But, you know, pitchers do have an offense. If they don't score for him, they
puts more pressure.
But the choices with the body weight, at one point, he was averaging 30 points a game. And now they lost a touchdown this past year. They where'd they finish at? 22 a game?
22 or 23.
So, I mean, yeah. you lost 7 points. That's why you're – so I'm not – so my thing with him is let's see what they do. I think they'd like to get him signed to a deal. But are you going to get him 262 for 4 years, 5 years? If you get him for 6 years and now it's a workable number – because that number, I remember asking you, like, what's the franchise tag number for quarterbacks? These guys are all making 60, 55. If the Minnesota franchise tags Darnold, what's the number, 41?
We don't know exactly yet. It's going to be based on the final salary cap, which rose. It's going to rise about 10%. It's going to be in the 40s. But the thing about the franchise tag is you don't have flexibility to maneuver the cap hit. The way that the 49ers,
spread the money out.
It is a firm price.
Right.
And the Niners have been surfing this salary cap wave so well. And the Eagles have been doing it so well. And somebody who's also done it really well with their quarterback are the Chiefs. The 10-year deal for Mahomes, I'm still shocked that he chose to bound himself to team control.
But this was after he won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, no.
He beat us in 19.
No, but I thought, a QB is going to want a shorter deal so they can hit free agency center, right?
Yeah. And I remember talking to Lee Steinberg. He was my agent. Lee's the one that did that deal. I remember talking to him. I was blown away. He also bought a piece of the Royals. He really wanted
to entrench himself.
And I think they've obviously redone that deal a little bit.
It's open to be redone. Right. And the quarterback always is going to have the leverage to walk away and say, redo my deal or else I'm not showing up.
No, you're not proposing the Niners sign Brock to a 10-year contract.
I think that because you don't have, as long as it's not fully guaranteed, you would love to have that team control. Because
you can
hit
spread
the eject
out 262 over 10.
Yeah, then they'd be really happy.
Yeah, but we're simplifying.
Here's the glory of the deal for the Chiefs with Mahomes. After 2 or 3 years, they could have moved on from it at any point. I'm not saying they want to, nor will they want to. But they have contractual control over the player at essentially no cost. It would shock me if Purdy would be okay with signing a 10-year deal. I think Purdy would want to sign something shorter. To hit free agency soon.
Probably. Yeah. But also, his salary does jump. One of the great things that people don't understand, because I get this all the time, he is under contract for next year. He's not a free agent. His salary does jump from, what, 1.1 to 5.2 because he made the Pro Bowl last year.
Yeah.
So he is going to make a salary. I mean, we'll see how they play it. But that's that franchise tag mechanism for next year, and it would be higher. Obviously, than 41.2 right now, it'd be whatever it would be. But it's not $50, $60 million. I would, he's played so few amount of games. Would you want to have a little more intel on him? My thoughts on him have changed. I still love the guy, I'm not saying that, but it was almost like, who is this guy? Like, he's a robo-quarter. He's like a computer-generated brain chip that just throws the ball where it's got to go. It's like Kyle, just programmed his brain and the ball goes there. Last year, he didn't throw the ball where it needed to be, to a degree where, would you rather have another year of intel?
My main thing when I look at that is they were still really good against zone last year, and it was the splits against man coverage, which generally I think is very much outside. They had the lowest separation numbers in the entire league.
Yeah.
So I just think that there are cascading effects, and it's very hard to determine, okay, this is this guy's fault, and this is because it's a team sport. And that's, we just talked for an hour and a half about how beautiful this sport is because there's so many variables that we have to address.
When you invest those kind of dollars on someone, you really have to be absolutely positively sure. And I think even after the Super Bowl, he played very well, well enough to win the game, but there's throws that third down McDuffie blitz. If he makes the proper read and gets the ball out against that blitz, and Spags knew to blitz him inside because of the size. So we'll see what they do. They love the guy. If they can get a workable number they feel comfortable with, then maybe they do that. But I don't think they're in a position, right? They got to rebuild an entire defense. And what's that going to cost them to do that? We were talking about Myles Garrett. You put Myles Garrett on this team, it's a game changer. But how do you do that? And draft pick compensation, and then do you have to redo his contract? And now, do you really want to get in the market where you're giving the quarterback those kind of dollars? I mean, you can kick the can down the road another year before you have to commit to him. Now, how is he going to handle that if you do that? I'm not saying, this is my opinion, is that for the first time you have, you know, the team did not perform as well this year.
Yeah.
You have to be honest about that. I mean, you can say, well, McCaffrey got hurt, Ayuk got hurt, Debo wasn't playing well, Trent was out. That's all true. But, you know, the facts are the facts. You see it with your own eyes that the ball didn't go as frequently to where it needed to go. That's the only point I would make.
We've got a lot to talk about this offseason. I think that just scratches the surface. You know, when we're going to be texting throughout all of this, but a couple weeks from now, once the combine is behind us, free agency starts, then the draft a couple months from now, we'll finally start to see the vision, and maybe we'll have an answer on this whole Brock Purdy thing. But thanks so much.
Thank you. I had a lot of fun, my friend. Love this guy.
Awesome.
You're the best.
You're the best at what you do as well. So we will keep you posted throughout this entire season on the San Francisco Standard. This has been our first long-form guest, Greg Papa, play-by-play voice of the 49ers. Many more coming soon. Thanks to Greg. We'll talk to you next time.